I'm almost at the bottom of my window with Slack. You know, the little, like, the column of icons. I'm pretty much almost full there.
Like, all the different Slacks you're on?
Yep.
My God.
I'm in 3 Destiny Slacks alone. Just for Destiny. Even before you go, like, podcast, tech, friend. My work has one now. I think my work has multiple ones, but only in one of them. Slack proliferation is a thing.
So you aren't in all the ones for work, but you are in multiple Destiny Slacks.
Yep. I'm not in all the Destiny Slacks that exist. I'm just, yeah, people can't get their acts together with their Destiny Slacks.
All right, so we want to actually talk about something that's relevant tonight.
Do we ever, really?
Not really.
What is relevant?
Yeah, important follow-up that's not really follow-up. I guess we could even call it follow-out. You have a new show.
No, we couldn't.
Yeah, I started a new developer podcast with our friend underscore David Smith, who is the app developer and podcast indexer extraordinaire. He and I talked about it last summer at WWDC. Well, this summer at WWDC, talked about doing it, and then just, you know, life got in the way for both of us. And now we finally got it together and are doing it, and we published our first episode today. So far, it's doing well. Check it out. It's called Under the Radar, and it's basically, you know, he had his show Developing Perspective, and he has now basically ended it to do this. This is kind of the successor to that. I, back in the day, did Build and Analyze. And so this is kind of the combination of those two shows. It is kind of like the successor to Build and Analyze and Developing Perspective. It's really a developer-focused show. Like, this show is kind of more general Apple tech world. That show is really developers. And it's limited to only 30 minutes. So it's a quick, you know, 30 minutes a week. So it's not too time costly to subscribe. So go check it out.
That's excellent. It's for developers. So at this point, it is unequivocal that all of us have shows on Relay FM. I mean, I know you had top four before this, and so this is. At what point do we join Relay? I mean, at this point, we're pretty much there.
People have asked. No, and honestly, it's worth talking about briefly if anybody actually cares about the answer. The answer basically is that we didn't start on Relay. And there's not really, like, as much as we love Relay, we don't really have a lot of reason to move ATP there because it's already going on its own. It's already independent. We already have our own ad sales and hosting and everything set up already. So there's just not much reason to move it in. But starting a new show, David and I, we didn't even question. Of course, we're going to start it on Relay just because, you know, there's, and I've talked about podcast networks before, and I've been against them in certain ways and for them in certain others. And the reality is a podcast network is a trade-off. You lose control, you lose some of the money, and you lose some of the branding. But what you get is you have to do a lot less work to make the shows. And so depending on what you need the show to do and what your priorities are and how much time you have, that can determine kind of, you know, where you fall on that. And so for this new show, given where we were, we decided a network was the right move for our needs right now.
That makes sense. And folks at Relay are really awesome. And they're all good friends of ours. We really enjoy them. So, yep. I mean, I think if ATP were to start tomorrow, it probably would be on Relay. But at this point, don't fix what ain't broke. So,
yep.
All right. So now that we're done with follow out, asterisk not Syracuse approved, let's do some follow up. Somebody wrote in Dusto, that's got to be pronounced wrong because there's a fancy strike through the O. Masterson wrote in to us.
It's Dust Zero.
Dust Zero. That's true. That is actually how I write zeros. Anyways, this individual said, another thing about the Facebook app thing, it autoplays videos in your timeline and even muted videos take over iOS's audio. This is, if you remember, because Facebook claims that, oh, it was just an accidental bug that we had videos that played and never released the audio session, and that's why we were backgrounded for forever. That still strikes me as a little weird and a little aggressive for them to autoplay videos, but I don't know. It seems like everyone's kind of starting to believe that this is really their ineptitude and not nefarious actions. Is that what the going theory is now?
Well, the fact that they autoplay, that was brought up by a couple of people. I just put this one in there because, like, hey, I didn't watch a video on the Facebook app and it's still eating my battery. Well, you didn't probably watch a video as in intentionally tap on a little play button. But if you just launch Facebook, apparently, and scroll through your timeline, it, you know, it considers it will start playing it. It will grab the audio session, even if you just scroll past it or whatever. So a lot of people are sort of unknowingly implicitly playing videos merely by launching the app and scrolling through the timeline, which would further explain why, you know, this audio session bug thing is biting lots of people, even people who don't have any recollection of ever watching a video.
That makes sense. All right. Jeff Strobel wrote in and told us that he knows how to have Spotlight index his Synology 1815 Plus. Which one? I don't remember which one of us was talking about that, because it wasn't me.
I was. Yeah, because I was saying how, like, one of the reasons why I like Direct Attached or iSCSI over regular network shares is that regular network shares don't have the Spotlight integration. They don't have, like, system integration. And I just hate how slow it is to connect to and browse network shares still in 2015, even over wired gigabit networks.
Fair enough. So Jeff has the appropriate commands that are sitting in our show notes, which are not helpful to the listeners, and reading this out will also be not helpful. So we will link to something, some way, somehow that explains this.
Stack Exchange question that answers this. I remember doing it back when Spotlight was first introduced. Like, one of the bragging rights is, oh, even index your network. This was back in the AFP days. Even index your network shares. I don't know what the status of that is, like if it doesn't do it by default anymore or whatever, but it's bottom line is there's command line tools where you can force it to. There's the MD util command line and the MD import command line. If you just read the man pages for them, you could figure it out. We'll try to put a link to the Stack Exchange question in the show notes so you can follow through it and figure out how to enable it yourself. I don't know what it will be like. I'm not even sure how it keeps track of what has been updated there. Does it periodically rescan the whole drive? Anyway, maybe you just have to run it on a schedule to rescan the drive. But if this is something you want to do, you can try it.
Excellent. All right. And Rich Knight wrote in to ask us some questions about Google and Stitcher. He says, it seems that the biggest issue that you guys have with these apps applies equally to Google and Stitcher is that they rehost your files. That impacts your stats and you lose control over quality, making changes, etc. My question is, why do they bother? Let's imagine Google built the exact same app, but without rehosting. If they want to inject ads at the beginning or at the end, they can still do it client side. They could still build interesting things like full text search that John had mentioned by simply downloading your file once to index it. It wouldn't tick off the publishers, who would still have control over their files and download stats. Bandwidth costs shift back to the publishers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is all good for them. So what's the big benefit of rehosting in the first place?
So this is, again, the podcast thing specifically, Google's podcast thing with Google Play Music that they announced, and Stitcher, the podcast thing, rehosting people's podcast files before serving them, and then therefore requiring publisher approval and denying publisher stats and everything else. The main benefits are really, it comes down to control and consistency. If you rehost the files yourself as the intermediary service provider, you can, first of all, you can guarantee that they will be there and that they will load quickly. Because if you just rely, you know, Overcast doesn't work the way. Overcast and most podcast apps, they get the files directly from the publisher's server, which could be a terrible little web hosting box. It could be a nice CDN. It could be something very far away or very geographically close. And there's wide variety in transfer speeds, download speeds for podcast files that just come directly from the publishers. So if you're running a service like Google Play Music or Stitcher, if you want like some kind of big integrated experience, you don't want to take the risk of wondering whether someone else's server will actually be able to serve you the file at the moment that user requests it. So that's the biggest reason, and you don't know how quickly they will serve it too. So that's the biggest reason why they want to do this. There's also, you know, there's other additional things you can do. For instance, like you know, Rich mentioned that Google is most certainly going to do the transcription thing that it does to YouTube videos for search, and you could indeed fetch the file once, transcribe it, and then continue to send people to the original to download it. But then you have to like manage, do I still have the most up-to-date copy? You have to pull it periodically to make sure you still have the most up-to-date copy. Then you have to update it if it's changed. And you never quite can be sure necessarily if the people are going to get the exact version you got. Additionally, and this is actually one thing that might be a problem for Play Music, one thing that's really taking off big time in big podcasting, and you know, like the big, like the public radio kind of shows, the big name shows that we get lots of downloads and stuff, is that dynamic ad insertion, where every copy of the file they serve has a different set of ads in it. And the idea here is they want to capture, so you know, suppose they sell an ad for a certain number of downloads. They want to make sure that once those downloads have happened, they can put a different ad in there that they've sold separately. And for lots of reasons, I honestly don't think this is a very good idea. But regardless of what I think, people are doing it. You know, this is where a lot of the market is moving. And so if you make subsequent requests to the same file on some of these big networks, you will get actually different copies of the file with different ads that might even be slightly different lengths. So like, you can't even link to a timestamp in the middle of the file because it might be a different timestamp for depending on who downloads it. Anyway, all of that is kind of messed up by systems like this that cache the file and everything. But it also kind of throws a wrench in anything like Overcast that assumes that the file will be generally the same if you go to fetch it a second time. So there's justification on both sides for why you would rehost the files as a service provider versus why you would want to pass them through. Neither side is perfect. As a publisher, I greatly prefer that they pass them through to us, you know, but that is not necessarily their goal.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, speaking of ad insertion, have you heard about people who put different ads into like their archive shows? Like they'll put their archive shows up and then like a year later they'll go through and change all the ads in the year old shows.
It's exactly the same platform. Yeah, exactly the same thing where, and that's one of the ways they can justify it. You know, our show doesn't, we don't really do a lot of archive downloads because we are a topical news show most of the time. So, but there's a lot of shows out there kind of like the magazine style, like human interest kind of shows that are fairly timeless. And so those shows tend to get way more archive downloads than a show like ours. Sometimes those are even the majority of their downloads for certain kinds of shows. So they have different needs, really. Like they, if they tell an advertiser, you know, we generally get this number of downloads. You want to sponsor episode, you know, 200 or whatever. And then episode 200 ends up in the archives getting five times as many downloads as usual just because it had, you know, has longevity there. Then those publishers want to get more value out of that. I honestly think this is a bad idea because I think that those surpluses that happen here and there are actually already priced in to the premium CPM rate that we are able to get as podcasters compared to other media. So I think this is actually a terrible idea that this surplus has already been priced in and that we are actually eroding that by doing systems like this. And therefore, I think it will almost certainly result in a noticeable drop in podcast ad CPMs. But that's just me.
I think about people listening to old episodes of Hypercritical and I wonder, like, are some of those companies that we had ads for still in business? You know, eventually that's going to be the thing.
Right. And they aren't always, you know, like that, like there's obviously like there is an argument to be made that you should be kind of remonetizing. Ooh, that sounds terrible. Remonetizing these old episodes after a certain number of views or after a certain amount of time. You can make that argument, but I think it will have negative effects that I'm not sure people are fully thinking through. But it doesn't really matter because if enough of the market does this, it will erode the CPMs anyway. And so even if you aren't doing it, it will be affecting you, so you might as well do it.
Yeah, I like the idea of like when you watch old television programs, like the most fun is watching the period appropriate ads that run on them. Eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
Eventually people are gonna be going back to, oh, remember Squarespace? Yeah.
Gosh, that'd be crazy. All right. Any other follow up that we need to talk about? John, do you have any other follow out that you'd like to cover?
Don't even know what you're talking about.
Marco, why don't you save me and tell me about something that's awesome?
Well, we're back to John because our first sponsor this week is Cards Against Humanity. And rather than doing a sponsor read, they asked John to review another toaster oven. Syracuse are talking about toasters, more exciting than a roller coaster. Will it fit on his countertop? I hope the reviews never stop. So, John, what is this week's toaster oven?
This toaster oven is this week's toaster is something. This is the I think Nostalgia is actually the name brand, but anyway, it's the Nostalgia Electrics BSET 300, the retro red variant, 3-in-1 breakfast station. Before I continue with this, I'm going to put the link in the show notes or in the chat room. You two should look at it so I don't have to try to paint you a word picture of this monstrosity.
Holy mother.
All right.
Oh,
so,
my goodness.
Oh, my God.
This
what is that?
Amazing. All right. Hold on. Yeah. If you're listening to this and you are not driving or not in a situation where you will put people in danger by taking a moment to look at this picture, then please take a moment to look at this picture because this is amazing.
Oh, my God.
So it's like a toaster oven. And it's red. I like the idea of these things being interesting colors because they're boring when they're gray or black. So this one is a nice kind of fire engine red. The toaster oven part of this thing is actually pretty small. They show two slices of bread in it. That's kind of optimistic. Again, miniature bread for the pictures. But that's not all there is to this thing. Because the toaster oven part is in like the right side of the thing. Above the toaster oven is a nonstick griddle, or what they call a nonstick griddle. I'll get to that in a little bit. In the picture, they show eggs cooking on it and sausage cooking on it. To the left of the toaster oven, again, this is all one unit. These are not three separate things. It's just like the Steve Jobs iPhone intro. is a coffee maker, like a filter drip coffee maker with a little coffee thing in it. So
in the same appliance.
Yes. The idea is that in this one thing, you can toast your bread, make your coffee, cook your eggs and your sausages. That's why it is a 3-in-1 breakfast station. Now, the first thing to point out about this, when you look at the picture, it looks crazy, but I know they put things in the picture, like the miniature bread and the eggs and the sausage, but there's really no sense of scale here. If you think that coffee, that drip coffee mug, it looks like, you know, a typical, like, you know, 80s kind of office drip coffee thing before everyone had the K-cups and everything. It is not a full-size thing. It's like a doll's coffee thing. That container holds maybe like a cup and a half, 2 cups of hot water or coffee in it. It is not a full-size thing. So it's very, and I guess this is good, because if it was a full-size coffee maker, the thing would be huge, right? And same thing with the griddle, all very small. So it's strange, and it's like, maybe if you live alone and you just want to make yourself coffee and you want to make yourself drip coffee with like little filters and everything, that's what you can do with this thing here. So the controls, it's got, if with all this functionality, this is the one toaster that said, you know what, we don't need 3 knobs. 2 knobs is plenty. So there's a switch on the bottom, and the switch on the bottom, it's like a toggle switch, and that just turns the coffee thing on or off. It's like, basically, do you want me to heat up the heating element that heats the water for the coffee, or do you not? So that's independent. The top dial is a thing that lets you turn on and off the elements. The thing's got 4 guarded elements, 2 on the bottom, 2 on the top. You can say only bottom, only top, or top and bottom, or off. Those are your settings there. And then the second knob is temperature. And the temperature knob is fairly hilarious. If you can zoom in on the Amazon thing, you can see that the light, medium, and dark settings for toast are within like 3 degrees of each other on the dial. Like the whole rest of the dial is for all the other stuff. And this is not an accurate dial. Like if this was a surgical instrument, maybe you could say, am I between medium and dark? There's so much slop on the dial. Like the 3 dots are within the margin of error of like the slop on the dial. All right. But here's the biggest problem with this device. And I don't drink coffee, so I just made hot water. But
that's so sad.
Of course.
Well, what am I going to do? I don't want to dirty up with the filters and everything. But the idea behind this seems to be that rather than, you know, for space savings and to have like all your stuff happening in one spot, if you have like a small kitchen or you just want to do, like, why waste all this space? You know, you can do this thing, right? There's a lot of problems with that theory. First is, there's not a lot of room on top of a toaster. Depending on how low your cabinets are, the distance from the top of this toaster to the bottom of your cabinets may not be that big. And you really don't want anything that's going to put off steam or like spatter from sausages. Or it really just like, there's a reason they have vents on top of your cooking surfaces. You don't want there to be like an 8-inch or a 1-foot gap between your cooking sausages and the bottom of your counters, because it's going to coat them with grease. But it turns out that's not that big of a problem, because the way this thing works is, like, there's no separate control. You just pick, like, which elements do you want to turn on. So if you want all the elements on, the top and the bottom ones, and you turn the dial, turn it on, those 4 heating elements, that's it, except for the coffee thing. And they have to fulfill the job of toasting the bread and also heating the griddle on top. They're not up to that task.
Wow.
You blow a fuse?
No, they didn't blow a fuse. They're just not up to the task. Basically, my bread that I put in to get toast out came out as baked bread. Because it's just too slow, and it just slowly heats and dries and heats and dries the bread, and eventually kind of sort of browns it. And by the time you get them out, they're like little bricks. Like, it's not a good toaster. It takes a really long time, and they don't toast. You want them to be toasted and crispy on the outside, but not like totally dehydrated, right? And the second problem is, the only things that are heating the griddle part are the top 2 elements. And they're not enough. They just, you know, the instruction guide's like, oh, you should preheat it for 5 minutes. I don't want to preheat. If I'm doing that, I'm losing the whole convenience thing. So I cooked an egg on top of this thing, and it was the worst. Like, it just did not get hot enough to really cook the egg. And by the way, the surface on the top of this is like pillowed, like a pillowed quilt, you know, like a bunch of little rounded rectangle lumps all over it. I don't understand what the pillowing is there for. All it does is make it more likely that your egg is going to stick because it has more sort of nooks and crannies to go into. Maybe it's for the grease from your sausages to drain out or something. Anyway, terrible for cooking eggs. Just does not get hot enough fast enough. Doesn't get hot enough, period. And I don't see any extra convenience. And the coffee maker thing is totally disconnected from the toaster and the griddle. It might as well be separate because it's just like, well, this is a very small, low-capacity thing that heats hot water for drip coffee. So just like the thing that was a slot toaster in the toaster oven, this multi-function device does none of its functions well. Maybe, I'm going to say maybe it does the coffee thing well. Maybe it is a good single-serving drip coffee thing. But
I really doubt it.
All I can say is that it does boil the water in a reasonably timely fashion because, hey, it's only boiling like one cup of water.
Probably isn't boiling. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it did. Well, yeah, probably not. And it did. It didn't blow a circuit or anything, but it really should have because if you want to, it just was not getting hot enough. The top, if you're wondering how the hell you wash this thing, the griddle top thing comes right off, which seems weird to me because if you take it off and turn the toaster on, you've got hot heating elements on it, opens the air. Anyway, it comes off and you can clean it easily. That's about the only good thing I can say about this. The door. And the other thing I say about it is that it's cute. Like, this is a cute nostalgia thing. The fact that it's red and it looks kind of like, I don't know. I thought this was a cute appliance. So it would look good in the background of a movie or sitcom, but don't actually use it to heat up any of your food to make it better to eat. Cannot recommend.
Even at its bargain price for three different appliances, the combination of only $70 doesn't seem that ridiculous.
I wouldn't spend $70 on this because you can get a good toaster for less money than that. This is not a good toaster. It's not good at anything. So I don't, if I had this in my house, I don't know what I would use it for. I would use it for nothing.
If I paid you $70 to keep it on your counter, would you?
No, I don't have that kind of counter space. Oh, and I forgot to mention, there's also a lid that goes on the griddle thing on the top. And I can only assume that's like, look, we know this thing doesn't get hot enough, but if you put the lid on, it will steam your eggs at least, and they'll actually kind of cook.
Awesome. So my final question on this is from this brand called Nostalgia Electronics, and they appear to have a whole different line of things. But was this kind of thing ever a thing that people use? Like, it kind of implies that this is an old appliance that they're bringing back, hence nostalgia. But was this kind of appliance ever really used by anybody ever?
I assume the nostalgia brand is only loosely connected with the theme of actual nostalgia. And I'm guessing based on the appearance, that just the idea is make it look like appliances looked then, not that there was a specific appliance like this. And it does, like, with the script lettering and the red metal and everything, it does look like a little bit of a throwback, but it's got this big plastic thing on top of the coffee maker that doesn't quite look right. But it does kind of fit in with the sort of 50s, 60s sci-fi, like, the kitchen of the future, automation, and, you know, it does fit in. Even if they never made one of these things, it totally fits with that theme, especially with the fact that it doesn't work worth a damn, just like every one of the kitchen of the future things they made up in the 50s and 60s.
They should have just called it Sad Electrics, because I think, like, wow, there is no way to use this and not be sad somehow. Either just you're using it because your life situation somehow led you to buy and own one of these things, or you are sad because its performance is so bad that you are sitting there eating your baked bread and undercooked sausage and just makes you sad.
People in the chat room are posting the positive and negative Amazon reviews. I can't believe there are positive ones. They must be like shills from the manufacturer. I just cannot believe anyone would find any part of the satisfactory, except, like I said, maybe I wanted a drip coffee maker that only made enough coffee for 1.5 people, and finally I found one.
Yeah, you know, a Keurig isn't sufficient. They really want that drip coffee.
Yikes.
Wow.
Well,
I did not know what toaster this was going to be before the show started, and I am glad I didn't, because that is magnificent.
Oh yeah, and before we wrap up the toaster things, two things in this. One, people have been asking me, and have been asking for this entire run of ads, what do I do with all the old toasters? And my answer for a long time had been nothing. We don't have any plans to do anything with the old toasters. Eventually got to the point where I had just too many gigantic toaster boxes in my house, and I needed them to go away. And so now the toasters have gone away. I don't know where they went, but a nice person came to my house and took 10 toasters, jammed into a giant truck, and took them away from my house. So they are gone. I no longer have them. When I was taking these 10 toasters and sending them away, I found this box unopened. I hadn't realized that I had an extra unopened box. This was like finding the strange treasure. Like, wait a second, this one's still sealed up. Did I never open this one? And I opened it, and this is the unholy thing that came out. So I don't even know when I got this toaster. Maybe it got filed away with the rest of the toasters, like the Ark of the Covenant at the end of Indiana Jones. Temple of Doom, Jesus. At the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, which does not have an Indiana Jones prefix. See what you've done to me, Steven Spielberg?
Now, by any chance, did you have a coffee maker box near them? I'm thinking maybe there was some hanky-panky going on, and this came out.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, so this is the second to last toaster of this run. We've got one more left this year, I think. And I'll have to get rid of these toasters anyway. So that's where they go. They go away from my house so I can fit my car in the driveway.
I don't even know where to go from here.
Well, thanks to Cards Against Humanity for sponsoring our show once again.
Wow. Should we just end here? I mean, we have other things to talk about. We have other sponsors, but where do we go?
I mean, it's all going to go downhill from here. Like, how do we top that?
What can we really do? Oh, my goodness. All right. So we do have things to talk about. And most specifically, we have some Apple TV things to talk about. And I don't know how much I can contribute to this because I'm holding strong and not buying the Apple TV that I'm sure I'm going to buy sometime between now and Christmas.
You didn't even order it? I thought you would have surely ordered it at least.
No, I think I'm going to try to hold out for a Christmas/Hanukkah gift, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, the Plex app is out, right?
Yes, Plex is out, which is why I am not really holding too strong on this. And I've heard it's really good, which is not helping me.
Keep in mind also that the way Apple's product release cycle and pricing works is that you're not gaining anything by waiting. If you're going to buy this model of Apple TV ever, you should buy it now.
Yeah, you're right. But I mean, I don't know. I figure, like I said, it's holiday time coming up, and this is the sort of thing that I do kind of want, but I really don't feel like spending the money on, in part because I really don't want to mess with my audio setup that we went through last week. And yes, there are options like the little kooky box that we found last week, but I don't want to mess with my setup. A lot of people, maybe this is completely reasonable and I'm a weirdo, but a lot of people wrote to me via Twitter and were like, dude, just leave your old Apple TV exactly where it is. I'm like, well, I don't have to do that, man. Like,
didn't you see the thing where you can use your old Apple TV as an AirPlay speaker for your new one?
That's exactly what they're saying. And I'm just like, why? That seems so crazy to me that that's the best course of action is to leave this old Apple TV that I really will almost never use anymore. Leave that plugged in because that's the best scenario. I'm not saying it's unreasonable for Apple to take away my optical connection, which is the thing that I'm all upset about. They probably did the right thing here. It's probably silly to leave that optical connection on the new Apple TV, and that's why they pulled it. So I hope I don't sound like one of those people that's like, oh, well, they changed that one thing I needed and they're wrong. No, they're not wrong. They're right. I'm the one that's crazy, but I'm crazy and I like having my optical connection. So in any case, I'm sure I will get an Apple TV. I'm sure it will be in 2015, and we'll see if I end up paying for it myself or just getting it as a gift.
Ah, you got to stand strong with the Sony Philips digital interface.
Exactly. Is that what SPDIF?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know that's what it stood for.
You ever see it written S/PDIF?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's Sony/Philips digital interface.
I did not know that was the acronym there.
Yeah, because Sony and Philips, they work together on all sorts, like the CDE and all sorts of like digital audio stuff, and so they standardized this thing forever ago. It's really old. And so Sony Philips digital interface.
Today I learned. Anyway, so what do we have to talk about with this? Or what do you guys have to talk about with this?
I got my Apple TV today, actually. So I unpacked it and set it up in a bit of a hurry before the show. And I also had seen it in the Apple Store before that. So I actually have some real world experience with this thing. And I have to say, after reading everybody's stories and listening to what they had to say about the Apple TV, specifically the setup experience, I was prepared for the worst. Like, I was prepared for, like, Wii to Wii U migration level of nightmare setup. So one of the things this thing does, I don't know if the old one did it as well, I don't remember, is when you take it out of the box and plug it in, it wants you to bring your iPhone near it and make sure Bluetooth is on your iPhone and just hold it near the thing, and it will sort of figure out what Wi-Fi network your phone is on and connect to the same Wi-Fi network and use the same password and all that other stuff so the Apple TV can get on the same network. And that part worked for me. I plugged the Apple TV in. I brought my phone over to it. I unlocked my phone. Waited a couple seconds, tapped a little dialog box on the phone, and it found my network, which doesn't really matter because I have unplugged into Ethernet anyway, so it seemed like kind of a waste. But anyway, that part worked. And then at some point I signed in with my Apple ID password. and I had to use the terrible keyboard that everybody hates, which is not so much a keyboard as a key line, because it's got A through Z in a single horizontal strip. And then there's another row with punctuation, another row with switch to capital or lowercase. And by the way, if you hold down the button on the remote, you can get capital letters without having to switch from capital to lowercase. That is very painful to use. I'm not entirely sure if it's more painful than the old way where you had to hit, like, because you have a swipey pad, you can swipe quickly from left to the right and skip multiple letters instead of having to go A, B, C, D, E, F. Like, you can go swipe once and go be all the way into like J or R or whatever. So I don't, I think the touchpad is useful for that. I don't understand why they made it a strip. It's not like there's not enough room on the screen. They got the whole rest of the screen there. Maybe with the rest of the UI and apps, it was better that way. Anyway, because I only had to enter my Apple ID, well, I had to enter it a couple of times, but not an obscene number of times. It didn't seem that ridiculous to me. So I entered my Apple ID. I went to Netflix. I had to sign in with my Netflix ID. It's kind of a shame that it couldn't get all this information from the previous Apple ID or from iCloud Keychain or from any other place that in the Apple ecosystem that it supposedly has secure storage of username and password. This, it seems like, is the main thing people were complaining about. I got asked about their passwords too often, that the passwords are hard to enter. And if you haven't read these articles, you may be wondering, why don't they just use the iOS remote app? That doesn't work. The iOS remote app does not work with the new Apple Mini TV. Does it not work yet? Are they going to make it work? I don't know. Doesn't work now. So it doesn't help you if you're setting up your Apple TV now. And that's a legit complaint. Like, it's a regression from the old version of the product. It's a pain to use any kind of on-screen keyboard, and the on-screen keyboard they have seems pretty stupid. I find with the little swipey remote, it's hard for me to swipe up and down. I don't know why it's not registering. It just, it takes it as if I'm going across, like when I want to swipe down to the next row of things or something for the punctuation. It just doesn't, you know, it feels like it's stuck a lot. You can also, by the way, if you have the new Apple TV, you can tap on it like it's a D-pad, not press it all the way down so it physically clicks, but just tap, like touch the surface as if it's a virtual D-pad, and that works as well in most places in the Apple TV. There's a little bit of a learning curve, I feel like, with the Apple TV. I spent a while with the remote and tried to discover all the possible sort of combinations where if you click on the left side of the remote and click on the right side, tap on the left, tap on the right, swipe up, swipe down, swipe from the top, swipe from the bottom. A surprising number of interesting inputs, all hampered by the fact that remote is really too small and awkwardly shaped and not the best thing in the world to hold on to. But all this is to say that my setup experience wasn't that bad, and I was mostly pleasantly surprised by the variety of ways that you can interface with this thing. The speed, it felt faster to me to navigate around than my old Apple TV. That could just be because it didn't have to use IR, and Bluetooth has less latency than that. It could just be because it's a much faster CPU or whatever, but it felt pretty good to me. Maybe I was like primed to, like, with all the bad reviews, I was expecting the worst. But I gotta say, I would much rather have this than my previous Apple TV any day of the week.
Well, that's a much more positive review than a lot of what I've heard. I haven't read any to my recollection, but I listened to this week's talk show with John and Guy English, and they seemed like it's good, but it's got a lot of problems. This week's upgrade with Jason Snell and Mike Hurley and Joe Steele, they were in various levels of frustrated to furious, I'd say. And I don't know, it just, looking at it from an outsider's point of view, in the sense that I don't have one, I haven't done hours of research into the specifics of what it offers, because really the only thing I care about for the most part is Plex. I feel like I saw an inordinate amount of grumbling on Twitter, and it seemed like everyone was really, really grumbly about it. And maybe that's my own biases that are surfacing, and maybe it's not that bad. But, you know, Jesse Char earlier today was saying that it's really a great device and everyone's just being a bunch of curmudgeons, and that very well could be. But I don't know, from the outside, it seemed like with the watch release, everyone was like, hey, this is cool. You know, it's got some issues, but it's cool. And with this, it seemed like, oh man, this is nothing but issues to almost everyone.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, this is different. So we've all, you know, many of us, people who have been fans of the Apple TV so far, we've been using the Apple TV for years, and it's been pretty much the same. Like, most of it has not really changed much, at least since the introduction of the second gen one, and a lot of it even from before that. It's, you know, it's been really the solid thing. And like, for me, the Apple TV is by far the most common device that we use for the TV. It is our TV. you know, because we don't have cable or cable cutters or those annoying people. We don't, like, the Apple TV is our everything. Like, I have an Amazon Fire TV on the front TV, and I have a Roku on the back TV, and we never actually switch to those for almost any purpose, except the Amazon one we'll switch to use Plex so far, although now we won't need to do that anymore. But the fact is, it's different. You know, the remote, I think, has some issues. It is unquestionably more capable in general. It can do more things. And some of the big ones, obviously, are Siri and the volume control. But it also, you know, like there, it has accelerometers. It has the touchpad, which can be, you know, more different levels of input and more different kinds or directions of input than just a regular D-pad could be. But I do feel like, in my opinion, it is a step back from a D-pad in general usability of the things we've used the TV for so far. So who knows where the apps and stuff will go in the future? You know, we don't really know that yet. Time will tell whether apps really take advantage of it being a touchpad and not just a directional control. But today, using the Apple TV the way you've always used it before, it feels very imprecise. And one of the problems with the key line text input is, you know, when you're typing things on this keyboard, there's a high cost to mistyping anything because you have to, like, you know, then go find the delete key, or if you hold it down, there's one on the hold down menu, but that's kind of hard to do, especially if you're new to the control. So you need to be very precise on that keyboard because the cost of making an error is annoying. But that's the first thing you really need to do when setting this up, is type in your password a few times. And that is the time when you have the least experience with the new remote. So your very first interaction with this thing is set up to make you basically hate the remote and hate inputting text into it. And who knows what they could have done to fix that. I think, obviously, better integration with an iPhone to let you use the iPhone keyboard like the old remote app did would have been nice. I hope they do something like that in the future. It's not there now, and that is unfortunate. But for me, so far, when you pick up the remote, let's say the remote falls on the couch, you pick it up. It is incredibly hard to pick it up without accidentally seeking the video that you're in, because you pick it up, and if your finger brushes that touchpad area at all, you seek the video that you're watching. And so there's little issues like that of, like, accidental input. There's issues with the key line and navigation of just imprecision because it's a touchpad. Like, honestly, if they made this remote with a regular up, down, left, right, D-pad kind of buttons like the old one as an option in that top area instead of the touchpad, I would choose that option, no question. And maybe in the future, if apps start really needing the touchpad and taking good advantage of it, that might change. But right now, I think everything with the new remote that you think of as things you do on an Apple TV, things like navigating, things like Netflix and iTunes and everything, those kind of things, in my opinion, are made worse by the touchpad, not better.
Have you tried to use your old Apple TV remotes with the new Apple TV? Because my understanding is it does have an IR receiver and that does work.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. And which is nice because, like, we have a universal Logitech Harmony thing. And so that can control it also because it works. It'll accept the old kind of input from all the old remotes. So that's nice. But then you don't have things like Siri. So, like, you kind of miss out on some of the new features. So, again, time will tell how this all shakes out. Chances are we're probably all just going to get used to it, and it'll probably blow over. But I don't think that takes away from that there are downsides. You know, it's very similar in so many ways, very similar to the Force Touch trackpad, which I finally got to try, the full-size one, yesterday in the Apple Store. And it actually was not as bad as I expected, and neither was the keyboard. I actually like the keyboard better than the trackpad. And if that's the future keyboard of Apple laptops, which I assume it will be, then that's not that bad. And the trackpad, though, like all the Force Touch stuff, it's always, like, almost good enough. But in my opinion, as I've said many times before, it's not quite there. So it is kind of a step backwards in reliability and precision. And I think the touch feel sucks on the Force Touch trackpad. And the full-size one, no different. I tried all the different settings in the Apple Store. It feels, in my opinion, the click feels awful on it. Even worse than laptops, I think. It's a terrible feeling click. But they've made this thing, you know, thinner, more advanced, more complicated. And they've achieved something that is almost as good as the old one. I think that's probably what's going to happen with the touchpad remote. Is that they've added all these capabilities by making it a touchpad, even though it isn't Force Touch. I don't want to confuse those two. But they've added all these capabilities by making it, you know, a touchpad instead of just up, down, left, right buttons. But the basics of, like, you're operating this thing imprecisely, often in the dark, often without looking at it. It's less reliable. And that, I think, is always going to have a baseline level of slight frustration for a lot of people, and more frustration for geeks like me who are very picky about such things, even though it will offer us more capabilities.
Yeah, on the previous shows, I complained about all the things that are still wrong with this remote before I had laid eyes on it or before I had touched it. That's all still true. It shouldn't be shaped the way it is. It's way too small. It's not made for it to be easy to grip. Marco talked about accidentally touching the touchpad. It's symmetrical, more or less. It's symmetrical, but the buttons are kind of in the middle, so you can't even feel your way to which way is the right way to pick it up. And if you try to feel which side is right by perhaps feeling the different texture of the touchpad and the other thing, if you happen to feel around and it's the touchpad side, yeah, you're going to move the video. All that stuff is stupid. It shouldn't be shaped like this. It should be bigger. It should be something that acknowledges that people are going to grab it with their hands. The buttons should be different sizes and shapes and textures and positions, and all that is true. But specifically on the issue of the touchpad versus the D-pad thing, like I said, I have trouble. I don't understand why this is. Maybe it's just because of the way I'm moving my thumb. I have trouble doing up-down. Left and right, I can mostly get it to do it every time, but up-down, I have a little bit of trouble. But here's the reason I think it's better than a D-pad, or better than the previous Apple remote, let's say. First thing, the previous Apple remote did not have a D-pad in the Nintendo sense. It had a circle, and I hated that damn circle because I could never feel my way towards what was exactly up and left and down and right. And yeah, so you're like, well, you're feeling the edges of the remotes. Don't you know that left is perpendicular to the left edge and right is, you know, like, very often it just didn't feel secure to me as an actual D-pad. It was with the actual D-pad that's across a cross-shaped piece of plastic, you can feel where the left, where the right, as long as you make the D-pad big enough, not like the stupid tiny one on the GameCube controller, which was impossible to tell which direction you're pressing, even though it was across. Anyway, I didn't like that circle. But setting that aside, even if you're comparing it to a full-size good D-pad, the most important thing that this touchpad has, despite the fact that the remote is the wrong shape, despite the fact that it's kind of hard to like reach to the touchpad area over all the buttons and everything and safely get to it without accidentally swiping when you pick it up, the most important thing it has is gets you out of the nightmare realm of controlling anything on your television, which used to be right up on Apple TV and on your actual television. And I've never used the Roku remotes or anything like that, so I don't know what they're like. But for the longest time, doing anything on your television, all you had was button presses. And so anytime you were faced with anything that had a lot of stuff on the screen and you wanted to go through it, but you wanted to be able to select any one of those things, whether it's letters in the alphabet, list items in a big list, or anything like that, you don't have to go next, 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 right, right, up, up, down, down, left, left, for you to do the Contra code to try to get to the thing that you want on your screen. You never had a way to go more than one thing. And so, yeah, on the TiVo, they did smart things like, hey, if on this menu, it's such a pain to go, you know, through the whole list, use channel up and channel down to go a page at a time. But even that was like discrete. It's discrete versus continuous. Having a touchpad and adding a little bit of momentum is incredibly freeing, because if you see something that's at the very top or the very left or the very right, you can flick over to it. And yeah, it's not going to be precise, but it's so much better than having to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Mentally, even if not speed-wise, even if you were stop watching me and it was actually slower, mentally speaking, it feels better to me not to be stuck in this like hateful game of Frogger or Crossy Road where you can always go hop, 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 hop. Now, the touchpad they chose to do it on, the shape of the touchpad, the fact that it like bends down, the fact that the whole top of the remote is made of glass, the feel of the physical click and everything, all that is bad. Like, I'm here to defend the concept of finally divorcing the television from a discrete single step or a single page at a time interface, because you finally have more than just buttons. And the sort of advanced things that I was talking about, Marco, you should try this. It doesn't help with the accidental swiping for scrubbing, because that's all terrible. But use it like a D-pad. Don't try to do the swiping. Eventually, I gave up on getting my thumb to correctly swipe up and down to get the Apple TV to register it. Just use it as if it's a D-pad. I like it because you don't have to press all the way down, because I really don't like that click, like trying to play Crossy Road, speaking of, on the thing, or Alto's Adventure. I didn't like having to press down and all the way click. I wish these game developers had accepted a tap instead of a click, because I don't like hearing click, 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 click. It's pretty noisy, and it just doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good as a game controller at all. It feels laggy, and it doesn't, you know, I don't like it. But anyway, just touch the touchpad on the left to go left. Touch the touchpad on the right to go right. Touch the top of the touchpad to go up. Touch the bottom of the touchpad to go down. Don't click it. Just touch it. If you want to go, oh, I'd rather go right, 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 down, 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 you can do that much faster if you don't have to actually physically depress a button. So I am pro having something I can swipe to navigate, and I am pro having something that registers my touch to do interesting things. The particular implementation on this remote is not ideal, but I would still rather use this remote than the old one. It's not a humongous win, but it's a big enough win that I would never, like, because, you know, I still have my regular Apple TV remote with the circle on it, which I never use. I would never swap that for this one. And I probably wouldn't swap the TiVo remote that I was using with my old Apple TV with this one, because, I, you know, like Marco said, you're missing the Siri button. But even just, I just enjoy not being in the business of hitting a button repeatedly to go an integer number of screen items away from where I was.
I can't wait for all the tweets and emails you get about the Konami code being referred to as the Contra code.
No, that's a valid alternate name for it in the...
Oh, yeah. But you know the nerds are going to come out and they're going to be angry.
Now,
our second sponsor this week is Harry's. Go to harrys.com and use promo code ATP to save $5 off your first purchase. Harry's offers high-quality razors and blades for a fraction of the price of the big razor brands. These are high-quality, high-performing German blades crafted by shaving experts, giving you a better shave that respects your face and your wallet. And more importantly, since they own their own factory and sell direct to you, they give you factory direct pricing. This is a fraction of the big brand's prices, usually about half the price of comparable blades from other brands. Like, I would say, personally, I've used these things. I would say they are very comparable to Gillette Fusion blades. They are very similar. It's a disposable cartridge. It isn't like a DE safety blade. It's a disposable cartridge. There's five blades in it. Very, very nicely made. Very similar in shave quality to a Gillette Fusion. But they're only $2 each or less per cartridge. So an 8-pack is just $15. A 16-pack is $25. Now, usually Gillette Fusion blades, which I would say are the most comparable, they run about $4 each, maybe $3.50 if you're lucky. So for example, Gillette Fusion blades, a 12-pack of Fusions today is $45. 12-pack of Harry's blades is only $20, less than half the price. Really, I've been a huge shaving nerd in the past. I know all about things like DE safety razors and everything. I have tried everything out there, really, for shaving, and Harry's is the best value in the entire business, bar none. I say that unquestionably, best value in the business. Plus, their designs are really classy, their site's really easy to use. You go and order whatever you want, free shipping. It is really a great deal. They're also participating in Movember. Movember is this kind of like charity cancer money raising effort, and Harry's is the official blade partner of Movember, so check that out. They have a special Movember set for just $20. It gets you this nice classy looking handle and everything, shave cream, blades, all this kind of stuff. So it's very, very nice. Now, you can get started today with a set, again, just $15 for a handle, three blades, and shaving cream. That includes shipping straight to your door. And even better, if you go to harrys.com and use the promo code ATP, you will save $5 off your first purchase. Check out Harry's. Really, I would say, again, the best value in the shaving business, bar none. harrys.com, use promo code ATP. Thanks a lot.
All right. So, any other thoughts on the Apple TV?
I do have more. So many thoughts from just an hour of using this thing.
I am surprised.
A lot of people have asked me about the video scrubbing. I've talked about my anger with how video scrubbing works in most television attached devices. And these days, also with many things that are in web pages or on iPhones. And I've heard a lot of good reports about the Apple TV, and I'm happy to say they all seem to be true. This does scrubbing exactly the way I always wanted it to be done. And this is another instance where the little swipey pad comes in handy. One of the worst things about video scrubbing if you just have buttons is, you know, like if you go to the end of the movie and you're like, what was that scene in the middle? I want to look at that thing again. All you can do is perhaps press the, you know, rewind button multiple times to go like 1x speed, 10x speed, 20x speed, and then it's going really fast. Then you have to hit the pause button so you don't overshoot it, or you try to slow it down. Like, it's difficult to drive the little the playhead in that way with a series of buttons. And the other difficulty I've always complained about is if you want to go to the middle of the thing or jump back half an hour or something like that, very often attempting to navigate at all just causes the whole thing to freeze and essentially do the television app equivalent of Beach Ball, where it's trying to load the video or the thumbnailer wants to show you a frame of video and you're like, just go to 30 minutes in. You feel like you wish you could have someplace where you could just type 30:00, go to that offset now. Don't do anything else. Don't try to show me the video sliding past. I don't care what you do. I just want you to move that little playhead to 30 minutes. And the Apple TV, at least playing like all the things that I tried, mostly like television shows and movies from iTunes, maybe it's up to other apps to do the same thing. I think I tried HBO and Showtime and Netflix as well, and they seem to do similarly well. But anyway, certainly for the Apple things, while you're playing, as Marco found out, if you swipe the little touchpad, it moves the playhead, and it moves the playhead no matter what immediately. If it has video to show you, it will change the little thumbnails and stuff. If it doesn't have video to show you, the thumbnail will be whatever the last frame was, but it moves the playhead. It does not wait. It does not beach ball. It just goes where you want it. It shows you the time offset, and it is glorious. It's like, finally, finally, they understood that that is the most important thing. All the other stuff, I don't care. Like, if you can do it, fine, because I loaded like an episode of Legend of Korra or something to get all the, you know, a small episode, so it had all the things. It will show you live thumbnails as you scrub around if it can, but if it can't, it always prioritizes moving the thumbnail. And then when you hit the button to play from that position, maybe it takes a little while for it to get the video and start playing it at that position. It's fine, whatever. When you're watching, you can click the left side of the touchpad. This is another good UI type thing. If you rest your thumb on the left side of the touchpad, it puts a little 10-second rewind icon on the screen, letting you know, hey, if you were to press here, it would go back 10 seconds. You haven't actually done the back 10 seconds yet, but it's telling you. And same thing, if you would just lay your thumb on the right side of the touchpad, it says that you can go forward 30. I wish those numbers were adjustable. I'm not sure if they are. But anyway, if you tap those buttons, you can go forward and back 30 seconds. Of course, we've all seen the cool Siri demos of what did he say, and then it goes back some amount of seconds, turns on subtitles, shows you what you just saw, and then turns the subtitles off automatically, which I think is a very clever feature. The only difficulty of it is, if you miss an entire conversation, I don't know how it picks how far to go back. I don't know how it picks when to turn the subtitles off. They had to make a compromise there. It seems like a reasonable compromise. But anyway, you can swipe down from the top to pull the menu item down to turn on and off the subtitles. Another thing that was a little bit annoying to do if you didn't know the secret shortcuts with the old Apple TV. You can fast forward and rewind scan. It's still not as capable at fast forward rewind scanning as like a PlayStation 3 is, where you have from like 1.5x with pitch adjusted audio still playing to all the way up to like 120x. The reason the PlayStation 3 needs 120x is because it doesn't have flicks scrubbing through the whole thing. That's not a problem on the Apple TV. I can go right to the middle of something or right to the end or right to three quarters through very easily. Whereas on the PlayStation, I would have to go to 120x mode and move over to it or whatever. But anyway, big thumbs up on the video scrubbing. They finally did it right as far as I can tell. If applications do it wrong, I will at least know that it is not the fault of the hardware or the OS. It's only the fault of the people influencing those applications, not doing it the way Apple does it.
I'm impressed. I really thought you were going to find something to dislike about this, but sounds like we're good to go. That's excellent.
No, I mean, really, I haven't done much video scrubbing with it myself because I'm not much of a scrubber, I guess. But I've heard only great things about it from people who care more about these things or use it more than I do, like John. I mean, I think that is one thing. Almost everybody has agreed that the setup process can be very bumpy with the number of times you have to enter passwords on that terrible key line. But almost everyone also agrees that the video seeking behavior and all that whole engine that is in there is incredibly good. And also, I mean, it's just good hardware. You know, this has the A8, it has 2 gigs of RAM, it's fast. I am optimistic for the future of this platform just because of what everyone else is going to do with it. You know, what Apple does with it is still a big question mark, and Apple's stuff recently has been inconsistent, I would say. You know, like some stuff they nail pretty well, some stuff is pretty half-baked, even well after launch. So Apple stuff I think will be less consistent, but third-party stuff, I think there's a lot here to do. There's a lot of hardware to use. There's, you know, and we'll talk about gaming in a sec, maybe after the next sponsor break, because there's a lot to talk about here. But I do think there's a lot of potential here for developers. I mean, I did start, I don't know if I'm going to actually finish and release such a thing, but I did actually start porting Overcast to it. Just to see, like, you know, how much work will this take? Do I have to really make a lot of special cases? Is it going to need a whole lot of work to do, or will it need relatively little? And so I've been playing with the SDK and playing with the hardware a little bit, and it is really, really nice. Like, interface challenges are going to certainly be there, but it is really nice to develop for because it is basically iOS minus some stuff. But it is most of iOS is there, and the hardware is very capable. And this is, you know, this is the baseline. And in 5 years from now, developers will be complaining they have to go all the way back and support the A8. But right now, a new hardware line where the A8 is the minimum is pretty nice because you can do, and also it has AC power. So you can be as power inefficient as you want. So you can do things that really crank that CPU hard. So it is going to be a really, really nice developer platform. I do have concerns about whether it will be worth developers doing a lot for it so soon. And that, I think, remains to be seen.
Yeah, the app, I went to the app store first thing to, you know, I was surprised when you load the thing up, like, it looks empty. Like, where are all the icons? Because the old Apple TV, it would just start off with, like, tons of icons on your screen, and then new icons would appear, whether you wanted them or not. You'd have to turn on, like, the, whatever, the parental controls to make them disappear and stuff. This thing comes out, and there's the Apple icons for the Apple stuff, and settings and search, and that's it. So immediately, the first stop is always, oh, I gotta go to Netflix, gotta go to HBO, Showtime, you know, all these other different apps that it, and I went in to get those, and, you know, I don't know if this was just the top list or whatever, but on this, the first screen or two in the App Store was all the things I wanted. I got, you know, Altos Adventure, Crossy Road, Netflix, HBO, Showtime, FX, USA, ABC, NBC, CBS. Like, they're all there. The sort of base to restore my Apple TV to its previous level of functionality, including only the apps that I actually use or that the kids use, was pretty easy to do. When I went to download this, I think this is the second time it asked me for my Apple ID password, and I entered it in once. And it asked me, do you want to have to enter that? Like, do you want to have to enter this every time you make a purchase? And I said no, because I really don't want to enter it every time I make a purchase.
I accidentally clicked the yes on that because I just misused the trackpad. It was another one of my many errors. So then I had to go dig around in settings, enter it again.
Yeah, and I'm a little bit wary about that because, I mean, really, it should have integration with Touch ID. Really, the remote should have a Touch ID sensor. There's all, so many gimmies here. That's, by the way, with the negativity about this, all the people complaining about the setup process, they're right. It's bad, and it's like, it feels like an unforced error. It was like, come on, Apple, you know how to do this. This is not your first Apple TV. You have name brand technologies across your whole product line that solve all of these problems. You had an existing iOS app that worked with the old one that gave you a keyboard. You've got Touch ID. You've got iCloud Keychain. You've got iCloud Photo Library. You've got all these things. They're all just sitting there, and that's why it feels so bad. It's like this setup experience is worse than the Apple norm for what seems like no good reasons. Theories I've heard, I think Jason Snell fielded this theory, like that the Apple TV was actually done a long time ago and wasn't launched because they were waiting for the content deals. And eventually they said, well, content deal, schmontent deal, we're shipping it. And so that's why it doesn't have support for technologies and things that are old hat as far as we're concerned, but they weren't old hat when this work was actually done on the Apple TV team. And that the Apple TV team was more or less disbanded and sent to do other things while the Apple TV just stewed there. I don't know if there's any truth behind that, but that's what it feels like. So that's why people are complaining, because it can be really bad, like it was for Jason, where he's got to accept the new terms and conditions, and he's got to do that on his Mac, and you're entering your stupid long password a million times with that terrible keyboard, and the whole time you're just grumbling, well, I won't let you use the iOS app. That is all terrible, and that's definitely worthy of complaining about. But if you power through that crap, kind of like I powered through that stuff with my Wii U to Wii transfer experience, and you come out the other side, you're left with a product that I think is clearly better than the old Apple TV in many, many ways, and that shows promise. And the promise is frustrating too. Like you talk about, I love the fact that there's a touchpad in the remote. I hate pretty much everything else about the remote. Like, I would like a good remote with a touchpad. And one other thing I would throw in with a touchpad on the remote, when you go to the app switcher, which, by the way, people might not know it's there, you double tap the home button, which looks like a big picture of a TV on your remote. It will bring up an iOS-like app switcher that shows all your apps, like kind of like the old-style app switcher, the iOS 8 app switcher, shows each screen next to each other. When you go between them, you have to basically do the equivalent of a D-pad input, swipe, swipe, or tap, tap. I would love it if I could touch my thumb to the touchpad, and as I move my thumb, the things move on the screen tracking my thumb. You know what I mean? Like, in other words, more like an iOS scrolling type thing where, yeah, you can flick, but if you flick, you're flicking like you're flicking the screen in iOS, as opposed to what this thing looks like it's doing is I'm waiting to get a gesture that I interpret as go left one. And it's not quite that. You can swipe past more than one of them at a time, I think. But anyway, it just feels a little bit off to me. A lot of that is because the touchpad is too darn small. But anyway, yeah, a lot of negativity about the setup process, all of which I agree with, all of which should be complained about, and all of which we're just really angry at Apple because they just seem like unforced errors.
Yeah. I mean, once you have it set up, it seems like a pretty nice device. But again, you know, we're all hitting this right now, and there's going to be a lot of people who are hitting this holiday season as they get their first new Apple TV, possibly their first Apple TV ever. And I do think that it seems like they rushed it out to make this holiday season, but it doesn't seem like it's ready. Like, there's so many little exceptions. It really does seem like it could have used 6 more months of polish.
It's not like the features that are there aren't polished. It's just they just aren't there. Like, why the hell can I not enter text on my phone? Like, that's not a polish issue. That's just a plain feature thing. And the other things you could say is polish. Like, oh, because Apple recently updated the terms and conditions for the App Store. If you haven't agreed to those, or if your credit card is expired, or you have to enter your credit card code again, or anything involving purchasing from Apple that is messed up, the television doesn't have a way to do it for you to fix that, apparently. You have to go back to your Mac and try to do it in iTunes, which feels really weird. Kind of the same thing with, this is not Apple's fault entirely, but like activating the HBO Go app, if you're a subscriber to HBO like I am, they all have a thing that says like, oh, go to your web browser and go to hbogo.com/activate and enter this 6-letter code. And you try to, and you go to the HBO Go website and it wants you to log in with your cable providers. Login credentials, and it pops up a little iframe, and now you have Verizon iframed inside HBO Go, which is all to try to get your Apple TV to work, and that is all gross and is going to confuse many a person on Christmas morning or whenever during the holidays. There's only so much Apple can do to fix that, but surely Apple can fix the equivalent of those experiences in its own ecosystem, and so that maybe is an area of polish. But yeah, just like I felt like if this the story of them having it done and then disbanding the team or waiting for content deals, if that's even remotely true, that's silly, because they just should have left those people on it and said, just maintain this and keep pace. And so when we introduce a new technology or a new thing, make sure it's integrated. And by the way, while you're there, find those corner cases for the people who haven't agreed to the new iTunes terms and conditions. put a UI for that in the thing or whatever.
I mean, if I had to guess, I'm guessing that the biggest reason why there's so many rough edges around entering your password, logging into the store, different store issues, is because this crosses departments within Apple. This goes, like, you know, from the engineering department into the, you know, Eddie Q-led store infrastructure area, right? And so, like, that crossing those lines has always been very messy in the products. That's always where people hit a lot of issues and errors and bad user experiences. And I've heard so many things from various people inside and outside of Apple, some of which conflict, but most of which tend to agree. Anytime the other teams need something from the store team, it's hard to get, or it's a problem in some way, or it takes too long, or something. There seems to be a lot of friction there, and I don't know whose fault it is. It doesn't really matter. The result is that when the products reach us, the consumers, we see that friction in the same way that, like, you know, as Microsoft was so famous for infighting back in the day, I don't know how bad it is now, but back in the day they were famous for it, like between Windows and Office, and a lot of times those infights would affect customers negatively and really affect the whole company negatively as a result. We see that in Apple in the way that the software products have to interact with the store backend and anything that uses the store backend. And again, who knows? I'm sure there are lots of smart people working on that, but whatever the cause, things that need to interact with that tend to work worse than the rest of the stack. And the Apple TV as a product depends so heavily on the store backend that I think that is really causing a lot of this friction. And there might be tons of well-meaning teams and people inside of Apple who are trying to fix this, but even simply through the way these teams are organized and divided between each other, it just might be really hard to do, and just therefore just doesn't happen, or doesn't happen well enough in practice.
Yeah, it's not all aspects of the store either. It just seems to be the things that have to do with, like, account management. So, for example, once I entered my password and I was downloading all those apps, when I tapped on the little install or get icon, I don't know why sometimes it said install, sometimes it said get or whatever. Anyway, they downloaded really fast. Like, I was just basically going through, tap, tap, tap. Like, it felt fast. The little circle progress indicator filled really fast and all of them. Maybe they're all tiny apps because they're all TVML and they're just tiny little. But everything about that felt fast. And yet when you had to deal with anything having to do with, hey, am I signed into my account? Have I done any sort of administrative bookkeeping stuff related to my account? Do I need to enter the little 3-digit code from the back of my credit card again? Is there a UI to do that in here? All that just felt like it was lacking, and they just punted that and said, well, there's 17 other ways for you to do that. You can't do that on your Apple TV. We're just going to throw up something in front of your face that says, go do this someplace else and then come back here and everything will work. And even with the weird sign-in stuff, like going to the HBO thing and signing in through Verizon and all that other stuff, it's like, okay, well, your device is activated now. Go back to your TV and it should be activated. And I always walk into the next room to go back to my TV, dreading the fact that I'm going to look at the TV and it's just going to be sitting there saying, please sign it. You know, like that it won't, that the dots won't connect. If that happens, like, what the hell do? You just go back and try it again. But every time I did it, it actually worked. And maybe I just lucked out on it. But that is not a seamless experience. Dealing with Apple's own store is still not a seamless experience. But some aspects of it are good. The video downloads fast. The apps download fast. The apps launch fast. This thing feels faster than my TiVo, which is ridiculous considering my TiVo costs like 5 times as much, literally, than this. But it feels faster. And things... everything about it, like, I can kind of tell that it has 2 gigs of RAM because I went to the app switcher and I went back to a game that I had played like a half an hour ago and the game was still in memory sitting on the place where I left off. That is a sort of premium quality TV box experience. It felt good, but yeah, it's just embarrassing. The setup stuff is just embarrassing. And I still think the remote is kind of embarrassing because I can't imagine, like, maybe people will eventually come to appreciate what I was just describing, the swipiness versus the tapping, but that may be more of just a personal thing where I hate waiting for the machine to do anything. And I hate the fact that I know I'm going to have to depress and release this little rubberized button to operate a mechanical switch 7 times to get to the 7th item. That probably doesn't annoy other people as much as it annoys me. And in fact, other people probably feel more comfortable feeling that physical click 7 times to get from place to place. So I don't think they're going to pick up on those. You know, the things that appeal to me about the remote may not be the things that appeal to other people. And everything else about the remote is just terrible, as discussed in previous shows. It's just too small. It's the wrong shape. It doesn't feel good. It doesn't look good. It doesn't light up. It's not easy to find. It falls down couch cushions. If you dig for it, you're going to accidentally scrub your video and be pissed off. Yeah.
Our final sponsor this week is Backblaze. Go to backblaze.com/ATP for unlimited, unthrottled online backup. I love using Backblaze. I've used them forever, way before they were a sponsor, because online backup is so great. It really is an amazing kind of insurance policy, peace of mind. For Backblaze, it's $5 a month for unlimited storage. And so between me and my wife, we have... I think about 6 terabytes now or 5 terabytes. We have a lot of terabytes backed up to Backblaze, and just $5 a month per computer. So we pay $10 a month. It's great. And you can access all this data anywhere with Backblaze. So they have these apps for iOS and Android, and you can log into the website if you're on a computer, and you can download any file you want that's in your backup. It's treated as a restore, but what it really is it makes all of your files available wherever you are if you need them. So for instance, if you have a file in your home computer and you're out or you're away on vacation or something and you want to access that file, you can log into Backblaze and restore that file. 25% of all their restores are just one file like this for this rule. Now, if you need to do a full restore, if you actually have catastrophic data loss, you need to do a full restore from your backup, of course they have you covered there. You can download it from their website, or you can even, if you're in a hurry or if it's so much data that would be impractical, you can actually order a USB hard drive with your data on it. So they really have you covered there. I've tried other backup services, other online backup services, and I've never had any of them perform as well as Backblaze does for me, and that's why I stick with it. So check it out. There's no add-ons, there's no gimmicks, there's no additional charges. $5 a month per computer for unlimited, unthrottled online backup. Stop putting it off. Get backed up today. Backblaze.com/ATP. And they even have a risk-free trial that you can try with no credit card required. It is a real nice free trial. You don't have to, like, you know, don't forget to cancel. None of that. No credit card required. Real free trial. Check it out. Backblaze.com/ATP. Really, don't put this off. Your data is too important. Online backup is awesome. Do it today. So let's talk about Apple TV gaming.
Okay.
Wow, that was a long pause. So John, I'm assuming that your gaming experience has been limited in the short time you've had it.
Well, here's what I played. I played Crossy Road. I played Alto's Adventure. Two games that I was already familiar with. I thought Crossy Road was well. I thought Alto's Adventure was the best test because it only has one button modulo the wingsuit activation and some other stuff. But for the most part. you're just tapping a button. And that's why I said before that I think that the remote isn't like the touchpad that you press. It actually, the touchpad actually bends, like it bends, the tip of it goes down. That's not a good button. Like, if that's going to be the main button you press, like to start doing a flip or jump or whatever in Altos Adventure, it just doesn't feel good as a button. It does not feel like a controller button. It is, I mean, it's big, it's easy to find. It's not like, you know, it's good to be the primary button. It just doesn't feel good. It's a pretty loud click. It feels more like, I don't know what it feels like. Maybe clicking a mouse button. It's as if every time you want to make Mario jump, you click an old style mouse button. It just doesn't feel like an A button, essentially, right?
Yeah.
And this seems like a lot of travel on it, and it feels kind of like there's a little bit of lag. I know there probably isn't lag. I don't know what I'm feeling. Maybe I'm feeling like the fact that my thumb has to go through a lot of travel. I don't know. I've spent a lot of time using all sorts of controllers, and this A doesn't feel like a controller, and B doesn't feel good, which is kind of a shame. That's why I was wishing, like, if they just did tap or whatever. Crossy Road, I feel like, is a little bit better because it's kind of more deliberate, I guess, where you're going hop, hop, hop. But even that, and then Crossy Road, of course, you have to do the side swipe and the up swipe to do the directional changes. And I found that the directional changes frustratingly inaccurate in the iOS games where you're swiping on the screen. I don't know if it's because I'm trying to... It's kind of like playing Zaxxon. You guys don't remember that. But nope. A sort of isometric view of a game where I could never quite... My hand-eye coordination connection could never quite get on the same page in terms of, okay, so am I pressing up to the left, like northwest, to try to make my Zaxxon ship go left in ship space, or am I pressing directly west? Like, is it relative or absolute control from the perspective of the ship or from the perspective I'm looking at the screen? So very often in Crossy Road, I will swipe what looks like left along the ground, but it wants me to swipe left with respect to the screen. Anyway, those problems seemed lessened somewhat by using the swipey remote for the television. I don't know why. I did, like, on my first couple runs on Crossy Road, I hadn't played in a very long time, I did really well with the television, so I guess the control scheme is pretty okay for that, but the button is still pretty terrible. Performance-wise, it performs like an A8, so, you know, and those games are not challenging. The games launch fast. They launch faster on a lot of our iOS devices because I don't have many iOS devices that are as fast as an A8 in the house. I can't imagine playing a quote-unquote real console game with that remote. I don't even like playing with the Wii remote sideways, and that has a real D-pad on it. So, I don't know. Gaming-wise, the kids seem interested in it because they play a lot of iOS games, and they're excited to play them on the TV. We played two-player Crossy Road, and that was a little fun twist as well. I don't know if I'll do a lot of gaming on it. I guess it depends on what games come out. But I know I would be more inclined to take it seriously as a gaming device for my gaming needs if it had what we know Mark already bought, which is a third-party controller that looks like a console controller.
Yeah, so about that controller, I haven't used it yet. It's charging up on my desk, and I'm probably going to try it out tomorrow night. But it feels, you know, it's $50. Which I guess is in the realm. I mean, what is like a PS4 controller cost? Like 40?
They're more expensive than you think.
Right.
$50 is reasonable. A reasonable price. Is this what you should say? What make and model this is?
It's the Steelcase Nimbus. Which is this the only one so far? I think it might be.
You can use any. I think you can use any made for iPhone controller with it.
Okay. So anyway, it's not a great feeling controller. We'll see how it goes in practice. But just like pushing the buttons, just without it being plugged into anything, the D-pad does not feel very good. The buttons don't feel very good. It feels kind of like, you know, like back in the day, I don't know what the current market for these things would be, but back when I had a Sega Genesis growing up, you'd occasionally be at a friend's house where they didn't want to spend the full $12 to get the name brand Sega controller as their Player 2 controller. So you'd be Player 2 and you'd have like the, like, not the $12 nice one, but the $7 crappy one. And it was like a third party kind of cheap knockoff that tried to be as good as the real Sega one, but never was. This feels like one of those. Like, compared to the other, compared to, like, you know, real Sony or Microsoft controllers or Nintendo controllers that are actually, like, good, this just feels like a third party knockoff kind of controller. And it doesn't feel, like, terrible. It just doesn't feel good. All that aside, And there was a great article that I put this link in the show notes. I wanted to bring it up. There was a great article on Polygon today, I think, that came out that was all about, like, you know, like, what are the best games on Apple TV? And it talks about, like, you know, how many of them actually change noticeably if you're using this controller versus just using the Siri remote. And like Rayman, like, it becomes, like, a lot of these games, like in Rayman, they give the case where apparently normally if you just use the Apple TV remote, the player kind of just runs at a fixed speed and you're just controlling jumping and stuff. And if you plug in a controller, then you have full control over the player. So it's like the games change in pretty substantial ways if you use one of these controllers. But in general, I think there's going to be two main problems that this faces. Number one, these aren't going to be AAA quality games just because the economics are not going to work out for people for a while, if ever.
Well, they could be shovelware. Rayman, that we talked about, I'm pretty sure is shovelware. Like, that is a high-profile multi-platform console game that they ported to iOS and now Apple TV. If it's the game, it's Rayman Legends, right?
It's Rayman something. I don't know. I haven't played it yet. But it doesn't matter. So there's going to be obviously a lot of shovelware from iPad and iPhone games, of course, because it's easy. But yeah, so there's going to be issues of, like, you know, the games aren't going to be that great from just like the budget perspective, because they're not going to be able to make that much money, you know, compared to like selling it for $60 on a console. They're not going to make as much money on this device that you're lucky if you can get $10 up front for a game or do some kind of terrible in-app purchase scheme. And the installed base for the Apple TV is going to be smaller than the game consoles for a while. Probably in the long term, it'll eventually surpass them. But for at least a few years, it's probably going to be smaller. So we'll see what happens there. To me, I think what we're going to see here, I think it's kind of like YouTube versus HBO of games, if that makes some sense. The big budget AAA games, that's like the HBO in this analogy, like, those are going to go to the consoles and the PCs because that's where they can charge the most money and really reach like the most hardcore enthusiasts who are willing to pay a premium to play those games and to really get into them and to appeal to game enthusiasts and everything. Whereas YouTube is kind of like, well, anybody can throw some stuff up here and most of it's going to be garbage and some of it's going to be good. That, I think, is going to be more like what the Apple TV gaming scene becomes, where it's going to be a lot of garbage, some good stuff. It's probably never going to be the quality that you'd get out of a AAA studio, AAA release on a console, but there's going to be a lot more stuff, and it's a lot more casual, and the bar is a lot lower. And because programming for iOS is easy, and distribution, despite all of our complaints in the App Store, is still way easier than trying to ship a console game. So, you know, I think it's going to be more like that. And that isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's just different. This is never going to be a competitive gaming console. In what we think of as a gaming console, but it might be a thing that people play games on, if that makes sense.
Yeah, real-time follow-up. Apparently, Rayman Legends is not on iOS. It's called Rayman Adventures. I'm not sure how much it shares, but Rayman Legends is on PlayStation 3 and 4 and the Wii U and 360 and Xbox One and the Vita and Windows, but not on iOS. Yeah. So I have some hope for the people who are good at making iOS games will become good at making Apple TV games. I'm really disappointed about the rules surrounding controllers. I'm disappointed Apple doesn't make a first-party controller. What you said about third-party controllers is still entirely true, with the one possible exception of controllers made for esports, which costs more and are presumably higher quality and better feeling. But the consumer third-party controllers, always gross. Like, even as recently as I think the last one I actually bought was maybe for the GameCube, but I always play with them in stores. You would think, How can it be that much worse? Like, it's a pad with buttons, and if you look at pictures of them, you're like, actually, the third-party ones look better. Like, they're better shaped, they're better suited to my hands, they're a different shape, I like what they did with the controls, and yet you just press the buttons, and you're like, what have you guys done? What did you do? It's just a button. How can you screw it up? Why does it feel so different or bad?
Right, like a Super Nintendo controller would feel better than this.
Yeah, and I don't know what magic first-party controllers have, or just, you know, you could say it's just that you're used to the first-party controller. You get the thing, you use the player one controller for a long time, then you cheap out and you get the third-party one, and it feels different and you don't like it. But there is no first-party controller with the Apple TV. There's just that silly remote. So it's not like you're comparing the Nimbus Steelcase thing to Apple's first-party controller that feels really good. You're comparing it to nothing, and you still find it doesn't, you know, feel good to your hands. So I totally believe that. I don't know what it is that makes first-party controllers so much better. Although I have to say that I'm still, you know, I've, I've been playing Destiny on my PS4 controller for a long time, and the L2 and R2 triggers squeak when I hold them down, and it bothers me a little bit. Have I destroyed it by playing 500 hours of Destiny? Maybe. I don't feel like I'm being that rough on the thing. I just feel like it's not up to Nintendo's quality standard. I guess the GameCube triggers did squeak a little bit too, but compare it to the Wii U Pro controller, which feels as solid as a rock, even though the thumbsticks are in the wrong place. Anyway, I may be interested enough to buy a real controller for my Apple TV, depending on how much my kids get into playing it and how much I get into playing it. But your review so far of the Steelcase Nimbus is not making me run out and buy that particular model, so maybe I'll just wait.
I mean, honestly, I wouldn't expect there to be a lot of these. I honestly wouldn't. I don't think the market can really support a lot of them. I think it can support 1 to 2, really. And only because, like, if this wasn't sold in the Apple store, I wouldn't have even considered it. But I was there to get a second Apple TV because I wanted one for my desk to develop on, so I can use the nice remote and not have to use the terrible simulator remote. So anyway, I was there and I got one kind of impulse buying. But if they weren't in the store, I don't think I would have gotten one.
Apple could be doing the wait and see thing too. Like, hey, if people really start making console quality games, there's no reason Apple can't make a first party controller and ship it with the next Apple TV, other than the fact that it will destroy, you know, the poor people who designed the packaging. They'd be like, oh, I have to put this in the box. It destroys my whole box design. It's supposed to be a cute little Apple TV, and I got this little cubby with the remote and the wire, and everything fits so neatly, and now you got to give me this controller that's bigger than that entire box combined. I got to find someplace to put this. It just seems like a shame. Like, that, a part of me thinks that's like half the reason they don't want to sell a controller is because it necessarily would have to be so much larger, and everything about all their packaging and their products is like, how small can we make the box? How many of these can we fit in a shipping container? How little waste can we make, environmentally speaking? And there's just no getting around the fact that if you want something for adults to hold with two hands, it has to be a certain size and you have to make a bigger box.
No, honestly, I think that is probably a really big part of the reason why they don't make one. They seem to do a lot. Like, I think this is kind of like what I mentioned last week about how I feel like Johnny Ive's influence is slightly too strong in the organization. There needs to be some adjustment there. I feel like the influence of packaging size is so strong right now that they do things like that, that like it's optimizing for the size of the box when it actually has noticeable ramifications on the product. So there's some things that they could use, I think, some rebalancing. But regardless, yeah, I wouldn't expect Apple to make a game controller that's any good, even if they did make one for themselves, because for all the same reasons, everything that is making Apple's products compelling and good today, hardware-wise, of like making these like thin, sleek things that are, by the way, did I mention thin? By the way, it's really thin. What is required to make a good game controller goes totally against Apple's hardware design in recent years. Like, I don't think they are capable of shipping one that is good. It would never get out the door.
Yeah, because it's the same reason, you know, the remote is the best example. If they could make a good controller, they would have made a good remote.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it just doesn't. And I kind of, like, packaging is kind of silly because there are, like, legit reasons for the packaging to, you know, to make a minimal packaging. Regardless of the size of the product, you do want to make minimal packaging for economics and for environmental reasons, both of which are good to go. But you just look at the Apple TV and the size of the remote, and you have to think, these two were designed as a pair, and they are in scale with each other. And it's ignoring the fact that the human beings are not in scale with the Apple TV. I don't care how big the puck is. Don't size the remote based on the size of the puck. Size it based on hands. You know, shape it and size it based on hands. And there's not too many things that Apple makes that you grip in that way. Like, obviously the phones and the pads and stuff, they want to be like, you know, as light as possible until it becomes a non-issue and you're holding like a completely clear piece of Lexan that weighs almost nothing that magically has an image appear on the screen. Apple would be all for that, right? But they make keyboards that you touch, and those they've been trying to shrink down, but at least the keycaps are still full size. They make the Sushi mouse, which you touch, but in a weird way. And maybe if you hold it that way, it's good. But if you don't hold it that way, tough luck.
I still like it.
Yeah, me too.
And they don't. Yeah, I mean, it's fine. Like, if you use it that way, but they don't make many things that you kind of grip and hold and use in the same way that you would grip and hold a remote or a game controller, because there's nothing on the remote or the game controller that you look at, the Wii U gamepad aside. It's purely a thing that you hold with buttons on it that you're not staring at when you use. So it has to be sort of tactile, and you have to be able to tell which way is what way and where the buttons are. And yeah, there's not much like that they make, and their aesthetic doesn't lend itself well to that, because you know the negative space formed by the gripping human hand is ugly, and there's no getting around that.
Ergonomics are ugly. Like, things that are well designed ergonomically are not going to be as visually attractive as a thin bar of soap remote that they can make, but you know, it might not work as well. But they are willing to make that trade-off.
Specifically things that you grip, because like grip in this type of way, because you can make a very ergonomic and beautiful door handle, right? Or a lever or shift knob in a car or steering wheel or anything like that. Those can be both beautiful and ergonomic. But once you're wrapping your hand entirely around something, like a controller that you're gripping with two hands or a remote that you're gripping entirely with one hand, then you're just all around the thing. And it's like, you can't get around the fact that hands don't want to go around a rectangular solid. They don't want, and it's hard. If it's a little tiny sliver of a thing, it's hard to kind of grip that at the same time as manipulating the top surface. What are you even holding on to? The little edges of the thing? Like, yeah, I feel like the people from OXO need to parachute into the industrial design headquarters at Apple and go, all right, guys, listen, everybody on the floor, you know, just like strap them to their chairs and just go over. Although OXO discontinued the good cheese grater too, so maybe they're losing their way as well.
So going back a sec, so I said that there were two challenges that I see for Apple TV games, and I only named one. The other big one is, it's what I always say, never go against the smartphone. All the Apple TV games so far, again, I assume this will change, hopefully quickly, and hopefully to such a degree that the statement sounds ridiculous in retrospect. But so far, I haven't seen anything on the Apple TV game-wise that was that was substantially better than just running that same game on an iPhone or an iPad. That's going to be a problem for a lot of games. So because, you know, everyone who's developing iOS games so far and mobile games so far has been doing it on these platforms where certain things apply. We know all these SDKs and everything. People who are making games that can be played nicely on a TV with a controller have not really been in this business, because this business has not really allowed them to thrive. So we need to either attract those kind of games into the business, or we need to have our game developers start making games that actually make sense on TVs more than they make sense on just running it on an iPad or an iPhone.
I wouldn't say they're not substantially, but it all depends on how you qualify substantially, because I think even these two games that are totally iOS games, like, you know, Alto's Adventure and Crossy Road, both designed with the control scheme of a smartphone or a touchscreen in mind. It's very, you know, Alto is like, how can I make a fun game with very minimal controls? Mostly you just tap anywhere on the screen, right? Yeah. Same thing with Crossy Road. Mostly you just tap anywhere with a little bit of swipes. They're totally designed for the very limited, very primitive input precision and style of a touchscreen device. But I think both of those games benefit enormously from being on the TV screen, for the first reason that your hands aren't blocking any part of the screen, which is, for console gamers, part of the thing that annoys about iOS games is that if it doesn't have an interface that totally demands touch, like Flight Control, where it's like, okay, that's not working anywhere else. You know, it's got to be a finger or a mouse, and the finger kind of makes it more fun. But those type of games, I like not having my hand blocking the screen. The reason I always play Alto on my iPad is I don't like how much of the screen my two thumbs potentially block when playing Alto on my iPhone 6, or even worse, on a 4-inch iOS device. I like seeing the whole screen. Games that look good, and I think Alto does look pretty good, or even Crossy Road, they look really good on a big TV. Big, bright, beautiful colors. Again, none of it blocked by your fingers. I think that is a big enough win that I like. If I was going for a high score in Crossy Road or Alto, I would now do it on my television. Like, I would not try to do it on my iPad or on my iPhone, because I feel like I would do better. It's like, it's better suited to even this really super simple kind of game. It's not like I'm saying, well, it's a game that takes full advantage of a controller and you couldn't play it at all on an iOS device. I think that's a win. Now, is that a big enough win that people care? They're like, oh, Crossy Road, I've already got them on my phone. Probably not, because from what I've seen with my kids, they're fine playing them. Like, they experience those games for the first time on their iOS devices. They're fine playing them there. I don't think they would feel the same way I do about getting my fingers the hell away from the screen so I can see what's going on. But we'll see. Like, my son is now he downloaded some first-person shooter for iOS, and I'm like, oh, you know, for like a phone-sized device, who in the world is trying to play a first-person shooter on a phone screen? Well, he's doing it. He seems to be enjoying it. It's not like he doesn't know the other experience. He plays Minecraft on you know, on the Mac, so he's got the mouse and keyboard controls there. He plays Destiny on the PS4, so he knows what it's like for console control, and here he is tilting the thing and shoving his little fingers into different parts of the screen to try to make the guy walk forward and jump and shoot. And I'm like, oh, that's no way to live. But he seems fine with it. So you may be right. The market as a whole is not going to see a significant differentiator for these same games on the television. But I certainly do. So at least maybe for old people who know what it's like to be able to see the whole screen, there is an upside.
The other thing, too, is like TV screens are way worse than modern smartphone and tablet screens. The graphics that you see on TV, the resolution, anything involving text, and I totally agree with Joe Steele on Upgrade this past week about how like there's so many like blurs that use these gradients that between colors, and you see noticeable banding on my TV and on probably many TVs to the point where it doesn't seem like this interface was designed for TVs. Like,
you guys got to get better TVs.
Anyway, so like it in many ways. Gaming, when you're used to gaming on iOS, gaming on a TV again is a step down in many ways. And I totally agree. There are so many kinds of games where a controller with real D-pad and real buttons or real analog sticks, whatever your case may be, a controller with physical buttons is so much better than touch controls for so many kinds of games. Not all, but so many kinds of games. And yet, playing games on a TV, once you are used to casual gaming on iOS devices, it really does feel like a big step backwards.
Another type of game, like this is one of the games that was in the top, was presented to me on the first screen of apps, and I almost bought it. It's a game that I never bought on iOS because I looked at the game and I'm like, oh, well, that's a console game. There's no way I'd want to play that on an iOS device. What is it called? Someone in the chat room will tell me. Oceanhorn or something like that. It's a Zelda clone, basically. It's Zelda, but not without Zelda IP. And that's a traditional console game. Yeah, the chat room says Oceanhorn. You run around and you do Zelda-like things with a character who is totally not named Link. And I assume there's a princess who is not named Zelda. And beautiful graphics, and it looks nice. But I'm like, I don't want to play that kind of... Again, maybe it's because I'm old. I don't want to play that kind of game on a console or on a phone or an iPad. I want to play that on my television holding a controller. And because I can't do that, I'm never going to buy it. Now, when I saw it come up on my Apple TV screen, I'm like, you know what? Maybe I would play that. Maybe it's just, again, the context that I feel like certain types of games that you're going to spend hours and hours going on like a quest and a game with continuity and saves and adventure and inventory, that I would just rather do that on a television. I don't know if that's the common case for people who grew up with iOS devices, but I definitely felt that when I saw that icon, that same game that I know is a quality game that I've seen lots of things about that I would never in a million years would buy and play on my iPad or iPhone. I was tempted to buy on the television.
I was just thinking also one thing that this would be awesome for that would make my gamepad purchase worthwhile is if good emulators exist, like for old, you know, NES, Genesis.
We haven't had a good NES or MAME breach in the App Store in a while.
Yeah, there was that one. Like there was somebody open sourced one back when the dev kits first shipped out. I have it bookmarked somewhere in one of my many tabs in my many Chrome windows, John. No, just kidding. I think in Pinboard somewhere. Anyway, so I wanted to try to run that because this really could be a really nice emulator machine, but getting the software on there through the App Store stuff is probably going to be a problem.
Yeah, I think my last NES emulator probably crashes on launch now in iOS 9, which is kind of a shame. My main one might still run. I don't, but in the early days of the App Store, for people who weren't around back then, very frequently someone would manage to get some kind of game emulator onto the App Store briefly before Apple would pull it. So if you purchased and downloaded it during that window of time, Apple wouldn't remove it from your device, even though it's gone from the store. So a lot of us have these emulators from like the iOS 3 or 4 days still sitting around. Of course, they're not maintained and the developer can't release updates. So eventually a lot of them just start crashing on launch and don't work. But some of them still do.
Real-time follow-up. Thanks to Jelly Bean Soup, which sounds disgusting, in the chat. I know
you're one to talk, Mike and Ike, man.
The emulator that I was referring to for Apple TV is called Provenance. And so we'll link that in the show notes. I will try it. Somewhere I have like a DVD plus R disc with like the entire Nintendo and Genesis catalogs on it and ROMs, but who knows? I gotta dig this out. Because, yeah, that could be really cool, and that could be like a fun thing to do with my kid who's now like getting into games, you know, because he's almost 4, so... Yeah, that could be fun. And if that does work well, then I will not regret the purchase of this controller at all.
So one final thing on Apple TV. You'll notice if you've seen any of the screenshots, the old Apple TV appearance was basically a black background with light colored things on it. A lot of the icons were also kind of dark. But anyway, the background of the whole thing was black. I like that for a lot of reasons. I don't like bright white screens in my face. But also because I have a plasma television that does not like to show a full white screen. And also because I have a plasma television with various regions of the screen with burn-in and other image retention artifacts on it from the kids watching Cartoon Network and the stupid CN logo burning into the side and the Destiny HUD burning into the left and so on and so forth. Obviously, this is a problem only for me and the 7 other people who still own plasmas. But I bet if you own a plasma, and I've heard from a couple of people already who have done this, and you think you don't have any image retention, launching something like, say, Crossy Road and having a big, giant, uniform teal background when the hipster whale comes up, you will notice, hey, wait a second, that big, giant, teal background is not uniform. I can see the logo of the channel I watch all the time in the corner. I didn't know that was there before. And same thing with the menu screens, where it's like you just have this big sea of icons on a big, it's not pure white, but on a big, light-colored background that's supposed to be uniform. But then you start seeing the little things burned in. That makes me feel sad. I don't think it's a reason for Apple not to do it, except the only argument for Apple to go back to a black background is just, in general, staring at a television with a white background is not fun on your eyeballs, especially if you don't have a plasma, if you have an LED backlit LCD, those can go really bright. And having a full bright screen, even if the room is not dark, having a full white screen with icons on it, not great for television. So I wish, both for selfish reasons and a few minor practical reasons, that they would tone it down a little bit and go back to black background with light icons on it instead of the other way around. And it also kind of feels more TV-ish to me. I think Plex's UI is like that. Casey can tell me if I'm wrong.
Well, Plex's UI in general tends to be, I don't know, it is TV-ish, but I've not seen it on the new Apple TV. I've never even used the new Apple TV yet, so beats me in that capacity.
So you think that it's conceivable that that would also be a light background with dark text on it instead of what I'm used to seeing, which is black background with light text?
The pictures I've seen, I thought it looked very much like the home screen of the Apple TV, and that it was like a very gray background with like white-ish text on it. But
yeah, well, they're using a lot of the layout templates that you get from TVML, so it does appear that it's going to be like a general light theme. And I'm with you, John. I honestly, I didn't realize, like, I had forgotten what this looked like in the event. So, like, when I got it and plugged it in, I'm like, oh, everything is really bright. And I also have a plasma, even though it's an ancient one, but I admit I would prefer a dark theme for TV stuff. It just kind of feels like that is the color scheme for TV is black with, you know, color where necessary, rather than what we have with this, which is just everything is just bright and full of banded gradients all over the place.
Well, they do vibrancy too. That's the thing I actually do think kind of works. They do a vibrancy effect where like the new app fades to the foreground, or sometimes when you're on like a setting screen, you can see behind it the sort of like you can in iOS, where they put a sheet up over it and you really can't see through it, but there's kind of these weird colored blobs. It's not straight translucent. It's vibrancy. Like it's that effect that you've seen everyone else they do in the television. And that I don't mind so much because it does tend to be darker at least, but it's the thing that it's covering up. Having a darker gray thing over some icons looks okay, but when it slides away again and you're like, light gray icons on light gray or white, it just doesn't feel right to me.
Yeah, well, and there's different vibrancy modes. One of them is super light and one of them is middle, one of them's dark. So it's really up to developers to choose, but I think by default and kind of like the norm on the platform is going to be things that are fairly light. And I agree with you, that's probably a mistake. But
And so you can look at the screenshots of the Plex app that we'll put in the show notes. It looks like it does the vibrancy thing. And like, for example, they're showing a thing from Louie here. Is this the Plex app or is this everything else?
Yeah, that's the Louie app. It's using all the built-in templates from TVML.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, since Louie has a picture of Louis C.K. with like a blue sky and some clouds, the whole background of the page is kind of like a blurred, smeared version of the, you know, it does auto color theming, right? Like Breaking Bad is like greenish gray, and so the whole background is greenish gray. And that, yeah, Apple Music does similar things. Like Apple's been doing this for a long time, trying to sort of have algorithmically generated color schemes that match the thing you're seeing, but still find a way to make the text legible on it. It is very difficult to do, and they seem super determined to be able to do it. And I think they do a pretty good job here. I like the fact that every one of these screens isn't completely black with white text on it like it used to be on the old Apple TV. Sometimes you get a bum color scheme. Sometimes things are hard to read. So maybe you could say, hey, Apple, like just pick one theme that looks nice that you can read text on. But I am not as vehemently anti-vibrancy as some other people. I think they go too far with it. I think it's a little bit silly, but for a television interface, I think this gives Apple a branding because they're the only company that's going to go through these kind of pains to stick to this, what seems like a very stupid idea for how to color theme things algorithmically. And they're just going to keep working at it until they get it to work. And, you know, they've done it and it makes it look different than everything else. It's when you go all the way back to the menu screen where it's like, well, now you're at the bottom and all there is a very light gray background with some drop shadows on it. That still feels wrong.
All right. I think we're good.
Thanks a lot to our three sponsors this week, Harry's, Cards Against Humanity, and Backblaze. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. Because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. Because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC. USA Syracuse, it's accidental. They didn't mean to. Accidental. Tech podcast so long.
When you get your Apple TV, you will have things to talk about too.
Well, honestly, Casey, now you have to get one so you can tell us about Plex on it.
I've learned enough about myself to know that I'm going to get one. It's just a matter of will I hold out for the holidays or not. And I don't know. This optical thing is really chapping my ass, and it's stupid. Like conceptually, I know it's stupid, and I know it's not that big a deal, and I can get over it. But it's real.
Just get one of those $30 boxes. It's not worth this fretting. The $30 box might break, but it might not. If it breaks, so what? Return it. Get a different one. If it doesn't break, problem solved. Yeah,
you can get two of them for the cost of the game controller.
Yeah, that's true. It's all, I know I'm being crazy, like I said earlier. There's no doubt in my mind this is a Casey issue and I'm just being weird, but I don't know. It really grinds my gears that's the way that is.
Shouldn't bother you that much. Because like you said, it makes total sense to drop that optical. Who
it does.
Optical anymore. You just need to get a new receiver. And you don't have the same excuse that Marco does where you're not allowed to get one that's above a certain height.
So interesting follow-up about that, by the way. It turns out, so to recap, my issue that I brought up last time was that I really want dynamic range compression in my audio for my TV, but due to household balance issues, I'm not allowed to have a big receiver that does not fit in this really, really narrow spot in our TV stand. And I have not found any receiver that is short enough height-wise to actually fit in here, even the Marantz Slimline ones, which are almost there but not quite. And then I also later on asked what the heck a soundbar was, because I keep seeing soundbars everywhere and they seem to be the new cool thing. And I wondered what the heck is a soundbar? Why do people keep buying what appears to be a big row of tiny little speakers? And turns out the answer to what I want probably is a soundbar, because many of them include range compression as a feature of the soundbar, which is a wide, skinny speaker array that can fit pretty much anywhere in the kind of shaped shelf that I have our TV on.
Yeah, like we said, everything comes with it. The Apple TV comes with it. Everything has it. Everything except for your television and your current speakers.
Right. And yeah, and so it turns out the Apple TV does, in fact, have built-in range compression. So that is also going to be something that will be a possible answer. But I've actually, a very kind manufacturer of audio equipment has actually sent me a sound bar to test. That arrived today. I haven't had time to hook it up yet.
Yeah,
so.
I don't know if you're going to like it, because like I said, it does sound different than stereo, and it's trying to find a middle ground. It's not going to sound like stereo, but like, you know, better sounding. It's going to sound different because it's trying to be like, it's just like a 5.1 system. So it's going to do crap by bouncing sound around your room that you may find weird. So it'll be interesting to see how this, if it actually is pleasing enough for you to keep using it, or if you say, you know what, that's just too weird. I'd rather have either just plain stereo or 5.1 than this thing.
Yeah, and I'll have to look at the settings. And there's probably like different modes and like settings of like, if I can like tell it to just try to make it sound 2D and like to not boost up the depth simulation as much, maybe it won't sound weird. I don't know. I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah, that's the other thing with the surround systems, and one of the reasons that people tend not to like them is pretty much every receiver comes with like all these weird modes, like pretend you're in an opera hall or you're in a stadium or you're whatever. Like, just do not ever use any of those. They're pointless. I don't know. I guess they're there to wow people in showrooms or something. Pretend they don't exist. And so with the soundbar, I think what you're probably going to end up wanting is, please just play the center channel out of your center speakers, the right out of there, the left out of there, and that, like, just have it go straight. But even that can sound weird if the speakers are angled behind the grill in weird ways, because a lot of time they try to bounce the back channels off of like the sidewall and the back wall to kind of, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And if they're in an angle like that, they're never going to be going right at you. Like, I feel like I was saying before, don't run a 5.1 mix out of less than 5.1 speakers, because some sounds are only on a certain channel and you will literally not hear them. And so you won't understand what someone is replying to. It's like you're not hearing the whole movie. So you have to play those speakers, but you just want them to play, like, just play the sound, like, if they could reroute them to the left or the right channel, or just play the sound straight at me, because I'm not interested in feeling like I'm surrounded. I just want all of the sound coming straight for me. Anyway, well, I can't wait to hear your review of the soundbar.
Thanks.
Does it even fit, though? That's another thing. I would love for you to unpack this thing and realize it doesn't fit either.
I measured, and it should fit, but, yeah, should. Is different from does in practice. We'll see.
And FYI, I have my car back for a week until it goes into the body shop.
Wait, why does it need to go to the body shop?
So the area in which my house is, and in between my house and work, there's a landfill. Don't be creepy. And one of the main access roads to the landfill is one of the roads I drive on.
There's probably more than one landfill in Virginia, Casey.
Well, in the Richmond area, I genuinely don't know how many there are that are accessible to the public. So what happens is people who perhaps live in like extraordinarily rural sections of this area, which there are some, but they're relatively far out. Or if you just don't feel like paying for trash service, you can bring your trash to the landfill and you can dump it yourself. Well, the problem is nobody actually secures their trash as they're driving up this main access road. And one day I was driving to work and apparently was daydreaming. I wasn't on my phone, hand on heart. I wasn't on my phone. I wasn't fiddling with the radio. I was just apparently not paying enough attention to the road. And I must have clipped like a piece of wood or something. And I heard this tremendous like crash or bang or something. And I discovered a day or two later, because I went looking around the car, didn't see anything. And I discovered a day or two later that I had apparently kicked it up with my rear passenger tire and it impacted on the fender, like on the very edge of the fender. And so there's like this really bad like impact on the fender. So it's going into the body shop next week for apparently a week's worth of body repair just for that one fender issue to the tune of $1,000 that thankfully insurance has already paid for. But yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah. And then you have had some car problems as well, I hear.
Yes. So fortunately, I have an appointment to go get my snow tires installed and get whatever BS I'm supposed to get at this mileage next week already. But so yesterday, my trunk stopped opening. So I don't have a trunk for the time being.
Well, just use your. Oh, wait, never mind.
There is literally no way to open it. So it's one of those, electric lifting trunk gate things. So there is no mechanical way to open the trunk. It has to invoke the electric motor that controls it somehow. And there's like three different ways to do it. You can do it on the key fob. You can grip the button that's on like under the trunk lid, like where anyone else would have put a latch. There's a button there that you just push and it opens. Or there's a button in the driver's side footwell. None of those work. They all, like, you just pull them and it just does nothing. And I don't think you can get to it from the cabin, because I think the whole point of, like, those various locks that are on the fold-down seats in the back, I think the whole point is that you aren't supposed to have access to the trunk without going through the trunk.
Well, if it was mechanical, in mechanical cars, you have a key thing very often in the back seat, so you put the key, actual physical key, which do you even have a physical key?
Oh, you know, yeah, it's buried in the key fob. I think I actually might have one of those little key slots in like the ski pass-through.
Yeah, exactly. And then if you get to that, what you can do is get to the one that they have to put in there probably by law for, like, if you get trapped in the trunk, you have a way to get out. You know that little thing?
Yep.
Yeah, little pull handle thing.
Yeah. So if you send him in through the ski thing and say, okay, Adam, pull the little red handle. He says, Daddy, I'm scared. And then you say, just pull it. Anyway, eventually you'll open up the trunk. But this, I think the first car I ever saw that did this was Agri CL. I remember looking at it and noticing that the trunk lid had no place to put a key in and no handles whatsoever on it. Like, I think they did it for aesthetics, like, oh, it looks so smooth and sleek just to have this trunk thing that comes down and you don't have any of these silly key openings or handles or whatever. I assume it was still mechanical and you'd pull the little thingy in the, you know, the driver's footwell or whatever. But what I thought was, well, that's stupid. It's like a Johnny Ive type move. Purely for aesthetics, you don't provide a mechanical latch or a place to stick your key in. Margo's thing is more like, we want little tiny electric motors and circuits that will fail because apparently electronics and cars are an impossibility, instead of having a latch. But on your car, there's a place, like you said, that would be where you would put the latch. You wouldn't see it. It would be fine. It would work. But they say, you know what? No, all motors. And if the motors fail, just forget about whatever's in the trunk.
Yeah. And this is one thing, like, so I got the electric trunk because it was part of a package and I kind of had to get it if I wanted a bunch of other cool stuff. Since the beginning of having this, I have said this is stupid and I would prefer the car to not have this if given the option to just delete that. Because everything about an electric trunk is worse than a manual trunk. There is literally nothing, there is no benefit. So first of all, it has like the cool feature where you can just wave your foot under the bumper and the trunk opens. Yeah, you know how often that works?
Yeah, you just stand there doing the BMW dance.
Waving your foot under the bumper and cursing at your trunk because it's not opening. Like, that's the kind of thing you try, like, twice maybe, and you're like, all right, I'm never doing this again. So that's problem number one. Like, those things just don't work. They work frequently enough that you can tell it's not broken, but infrequently enough that you never want to do it. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that the electric, whatever mechanism raises and lowers this, is kind of permanently engaged so that if you want to like manually close the trunk, there's so much resistance, you actually kind of can't do it, or you have to push really hard and it goes really slowly. It isn't like a bike gear where it just disengages when it's not applying pressure. Like, it is just always engaged. You're like pushing down really hard to try to manually close this if you ever need to. That's no good. So you kind of always have to use the motor, which is probably my problem right now. The reason I can't open it was something has failed and there is no manual way to open it. So there's also no manual way to close it. So that's annoying. And it's slow. Like, if you have a regular trunk lid, a regular mechanical trunk lid, you can close it and open it way faster than the people with these stupid electric ones like me.
That's the one advantage of it, is that you can't slam your hand in the electric one because it goes so damn slow and presumably has a back-off thing that if your hand was stuck in it, it would be like, whoa, 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 I'm getting too much resistance.
That's true, it does. But, I mean, I've been driving a long time. I've never had that happen. Have you ever had that happen?
The only place, well, it's for like little kids that get in their hands caught and stuff. The only place electric thing makes any kind of sense is for minivans, where very often the lift gate in the back is so high that short people can't even reach it to close it. And if you can reach it, it's sometimes difficult to get enough weight or leverage if you are a smaller, lightweight person to pull that giant lid all the way down. that's and it's the same thing on minivans with the sliding doors with kids getting in and out of it is a big, you know, getting your hand caught threat. Mm-hmm. So those are electric as well, because, you know, it may be hard for a kid to pull that big heavy door closed, and it's very easy for people to get their hands caught because kids are stupid and fight around doors and shove their hands in gaps to try to stop doors, whatever. And the electric one solves that problem and those things. And the final reason that it makes sense for minivans is a lot more minivans are sold than BMW M5s. And any type of thing like this, any kind of car-related technology, we talked about this with the Tesla Model X gullwing door things or whatever, you do not want to be this feature to only be on a low-volume car. You want this to be the 900th iteration of this feature that sells thousands and thousands of copies every single year so they can get the kinks worked out of it. Regular trunk lids and that they put on like a Honda Accord or, you know, a Toyota Camry or a Toyota Corolla, you can be damn sure that if there's anything wrong with that trunk closing mechanism in the next revision of the Camry, they will work on it. And you repeat that process for 15, 20 years, they pretty much have the stupid welded gooseneck manual trunk lid things and latch down to that point. I think the electric closing thing in your BMW M5 trunk lid is probably a beautiful bespoke mechanism made only for this year's M5. And the total number of electric closing BMW trunk lids sold in the history of BMW is probably less than the number of Camrys sold this year.
Bruce S. in the chat pointed something out to me or to us, which got me thinking. And so a little bit of real time follow up there. Well, let me start by reading page 39 of your owner's manual. Manual operation.
This makes one of us who has read it, by the way.
I'm sure. In fact, I think I cracked the PDF version open before we went to Germany, just because I'm that much of a nerd. But anyway.
You did.
Manual operation. In the event of an electrical fault, manually operate the unlocked trunk lid slowly and smoothly. To close it completely, push the trunk lid down lightly. It is closed automatically. What? What does that even mean?
That kind of makes it sound like if it's stuck open, you can close it carefully.
Very weird. Anyway, but to continue on, the thing that Bruce S. brought up, which I had forgotten about, in my glove box, but apparently in your center armrest, there is actually a segregated lock switch specifically for the trunk. So you might want to run to your car. Feel free to do that now if you'd like. We'll hold on. Run to the car and just double check that this switch is flicked the appropriate direction.
I might actually. Do you actually want me to do this and wait here?
Before you go, let me just send you a screenshot of the relevant portion, because I want to make sure you see what I'm talking about. Now, I'm not going to be able to put this in the chat room because I don't use like Droplet or anything like that, but I'll put it in our little robot here.
He does have a little GoPro on his head so we can see the Marco cam as he goes.
That's right.
I think I've seen that. All right, let me try it. Hold on, I'll be right back.
What kind of person doesn't read the manual for their car?
Who knows? Oh my God, thank you. I don't get it.
Because you'll never discover, the UI is so bad, you'll never discover, oh, if you press and hold this button, it does some feature that you always wanted on your car. Well, I guess it's maybe easier with on-screen controls, I found with my Accord, even for as terrible as the infotainment system is. At the very least, it was menus. So I could find, oh, there is an option to make it so you only have to press the remote once to lock all four doors instead of having to do it twice or whatever.
Right.
Unlock all four doors instead of having to do it twice.
I'm with you, though. I've read my manual at least once cover to cover.
Yeah. You just see the hilarious things that they tell you about engine braking and stuff. Like, seriously, that's never going to happen.
Any car I've owned, if memory serves, they're like, do not engine brake. That's what the brakes are for. And I always engine brake.
No, I mean, brake in, not.
Oh, yeah. Whoa.
You don't. Does your manual say no engine braking? I still do it. They do it because I always felt like they're telling you to do it because they want you to go through your brake pads faster. I'm like, no.
Well, I mean, and I think the thing is, if you're going to put pressure on anything, why not put pressure on the thing that's easy to replace, right? But with that said, I still engine brake constantly.
Well, it's a calculus. You put pressure on the engine if you're leasing.
but the pressure on the engine, maybe it's for more finicky cars, but I keep my cars for 10 years plus. Engine brake all the time, all of the manual, never any engine problems that could conceivably be attributed to engine braking, unless engine braking causes my radiators to rust out and my water pump to die, which always happens around 60,000 miles. But I feel like, what's going to happen? Your head gasket's going to blow? Like, what are they afraid? Is going to mess with the valve train?
Oh, I'm with you. Well, my valve train is now brand new. I'm with you. Oh, by the way, apparently this is actually fun, and I want to get to what Marco discovered. But when they did my valve train, they said that I should get the sheet out. It doesn't matter. But suffice to say, when they were pulling the injectors, which apparently was part of this process, they had to apply too much torque to get the injectors out.
Yeah, I saw that. That's just fancy language for them that they broke something. That's all they're saying. They were trying to pull something out. It's hard to do. And he goes, and then, well, you broke it.
Well, and that, you very well could be right. But according to the service advisor, who I do actually trust, they apparently pitched all six injectors and gave me new ones, which I thought was interesting. Anyway, Marco, what did you discover?
It was locked.
Now, this is annoying because you're the one that's going to do this edit, and no one will ever hear this. So, live listeners, this is a pact between all of us that you can remind Marco anytime you want.
That he doesn't know how to work his own car because he didn't read the manual.
Yep.
Who reads the manual?
Both of us.
We were just discussing that while you were gone. I always do. Because otherwise, I was saying to Casey, otherwise you don't find these obscure features in your car because the UI is so bad you would never guess that you have to press this button or hold this button or whatever activates this thing. Better with on-screen controls because you can read stuff. But if you don't read the manual, you just won't know how your car works. You won't know where all these little things are.
It was right in the center armrest thing, which I have, you know, there's like change in there. There's a tin of Altoids. There's an iPhone battery.
Well, so who's going in there? Did you basically accidentally bump it with your tin of Altoids or whatever?
That is most likely what happened. Yeah. I don't know, but that is most likely, you know, accidental bumping of the switch, which is right in there.
We saved you an embarrassing trip to the dealer.
Yeah, well, it was a combination of us Bruce S., actually, because I'd forgotten about that. And as soon as Bruce S. said, that thing in the glove box, I was like, yes, that's right. I completely forgot. And then
I think the last time we were looking in the manual for Marco was to try to find his battery. Another thing.
I have no idea where the battery is.
Other people are reading Marco's car's manual, but him, not so much.
Well, clearly, I don't need to.
Yeah, he's crowdsourced it.